Today is Wednesday, May 27, 2020. This is part 6, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Esther Litton, Esther Litton. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Esther. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Well, you sound loud and clear. This is good. May we have your permission to record this conversation? Thank you. Last time we ended in 1969, you had mentioned the Redwoods National Monument. Can you talk about that?
I mentioned what? I didn't get that last
one. The Redwood National Monument?
The which National Monument?
Redwoods?
Oh, the Redwood National Park. It was the Redwood and State National Park.
I'm sorry.
It was the dedication of a long struggle to achieve a Coast Redwood National Park that included all of the state parks. And it was formed in December 1968, and it was dedicated in December. Lady Bird Johnson had taken an active part in supporting it. So there was another dedication later in December dedicated to her. There was a grove named the Lady Bird Grove. So that was the completion of the finally achieved a Coast Redwood National Park that included the state parks, which had been Save the Redwoods League had insisted that the state parks be included.
Excellent. And do you remember how many acres that all entailed?
No, no, I don't. I do know that ultimately the virgin forest only consisted of about 1% of what the original virgin forest had been. It had been from the Oregon, Oregon line down to almost the Hearst Ranch, which was San Luis Obispo, and I don't know, but it was urgent that the park be formed because the lumber companies were doing so much clear cutting, and with the clear cutting of the storms that came in 1955 had sent vast mud flows down on many of these groves for which people had paid a lot of money to preserve, and more than 500 of the virgin Coast Redwoods were destroyed.
Wow, just in the flood alone?
Yes.
Wow. That's, So was that a 15-year struggle to make the national park happen?
1920s to the 1968 when it was finally achieved.
Wow. And did
and
you...
All of the Coast Redwood, the virgin areas are in the national park, but there are only a few places like Muir Woods up in the San Francisco area, which is a patch of virgin wood, which is a famous area in the Bay Area. And there was another virgin patch near Santa Cruz, the city of Santa Cruz. And there's another virgin patch down in Big Sur.
Hmm.
But the rest of the Coast Redwoods are all second growth.
Wow.
And people look at them, and of course, they're very big trees now. And they look as though they could be virgin, but they're not. They're all second growth. Because when you cut the Coast Redwood, it sends up four or five, a ring of other trees, so that it creates another forest. But the giant sequoia does not do that. When you cut the giant sequoia, it does not send another tree up. When it's gone, it's gone.
Wow. Did you get a chance to meet Lady Bird Johnson?
And so were hundreds of people there. Johnson and Lady Bird Johnson standing there waiting to shake hands with the rest of the guests.
Fun. Did you get a chance to meet Stuart Udall?
Yes, I did. Stuart Udall was a member of the board of directors for the organization American Land Conservancy. And Stuart Udall and his wife came to one of the December meetings for the board of directors of American Land Conservancy. And those meetings were held at a place in Victor called Post Ranch. And so I did get a chance to meet him, but Martin knew him quite well, very well, because he had been the Secretary of Interior with Kennedy. And when Kennedy was assassinated, he went on to be Johnson, President Johnson's Secretary of the Interior. And he was instrumental in many of the conservation battles.
Okay.
In fact, he was instrumental in the Mineral King battle. He didn't think it would work. He didn't think that there was any way to save it. But with the court, the Supreme Court, their judgment did save it.
Right. You talked about that yesterday.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it must have been a real triumph.
I don't know if you want me to start with the river trips, which began in 1970.
You know, I do in a minute. You mentioned the dedication ceremony with Lady Bird. Who else attended that ceremony that you remember?
In the ceremony the first ceremony in the park earlier in December, Nixon was there with his daughters and Billy Graham, although I wasn't there, but Martinet was there, took a picture. And I remember there were other people at Lady Bird's, there were other officials at Lady Bird's dedication. But I'm sorry, I can't remember. I'd have to look at the picture to see who was there.
No worries.
She was not alone. And many young people who had fought for the park were there with posters. And some of them said, "Fatten the worm," because the boundaries of the national park made it look like a worm. It extended from Oregon border along the coast down to, to where it ended. I don't remember where the boundary ended, somewhere around the town of Oric. And it was a worm because it included the Prairie Creek and some of the other groves that had been saved by Save the Redwoods League.
Okay. You mentioned Nixon. Was that President?
I don't know why he was there, because unless he had been in on some of the early controversies of it, but he was there with Billy Graham and one of the California Congressmen, Clausen, who had been opposed to the park. And, of course, Mrs. Nixon was there and their two daughters, and there were other officials. I can't remember.
Interesting.
Yes.
Okay, well, so to go to the river trips in 1970, it sounded like Grand Canyon National Park was making all the special use permittees into concessions, and Martin must have applied to be a concessionaire. Is that how that worked?
Yes. The crew from the Sierra Club let him know that the Park Service the next year, 1970, was going to stop giving out concessions. They were going to stop the number of concessioners because they wanted to embark on a 10-year study of what was happening to the beaches along the Colorado. So they urged Martin to apply for a permit, which he did. And he was granted a permit, and he had a certain number of user days, which weren't as many as most of the other concessions, but he was able to run several trips in 1970. And during one of those trips, he met a man named Ken Armstrong, who asked him if he had any footage, any movie footage of the river and the trips. Well, Martin, from the beginning, from not in 1955, but later on in the early 60s, when they started worrying about the Glen Canyon Dam, and they ran some river trips, he took a great deal of footage, 16-millimeter film. So he did have some footage. And this gentleman booked speakers and their films in community colleges and natural history places all over the United States. And so he asked Martin if he could put together a film and a lecture. The idea was that he would show the film, but lecture with the film. He didn't necessarily have to have the words on the film themselves. So fortunately, Martin, through John Blaustein, who was one of our first passengers, John's father was a producer at one of the studios, and he knew about one of the editors who had some free time. And so I think it was the 1 month after the river trips in 1970 that for 1 month Martin went down to Southern California and met with his editor, and also the editor brought along someone who had sounds for all the different things. He had the sound of the film Martin shot, didn't have any sound. Well, this man provided the sound of the river, the sound of people, the sound of cooking, the sound of the scraping. He had the whole sound effect for the whole film.
Wow.
And yes, it was. It took a month, and they put it together. And it was 85 minutes long, so there was an intermission. And Ken Armstrong started booking Martin later in 71 and for several years until California passed Proposition 13, which for some reason denied the community colleges the finances to have programs like that. Martin would appear with a film and show the film. It had sound, but he would lecture along with the film. There was no talking, no speech on the film itself. And he was booked in several community colleges in California. This went on for years until Proposition 13. He went to Seattle, he went to Denver, he went to New York City, he went to Washington, D.C., he went to Corning, New York, and quite a few places, and it was a source of some income. Each place where he went was a different amount that he would get in pay. Of course, he shared with Ken Armstrong, but it displayed to an audience what the bottom of the Grand Canyon looked like, and it involved aerial shots of it, and also involved some of John Wesley Powell's history. And he told about Powell's initial exploration of the Colorado and his working with the Indians and aerial views and all that. And so it went over very, he wasn't advertising the river trips. What he was doing was showing what the bottom of the Grand Canyon looked like. And it started with raindrops in the Rockies, and then the flow of the water gradually getting bigger and bigger and coming down into the Grand Canyon. And it did show the boats going through, and then I put the sound on, had the music. He worked out the music. And at one place where the boats were turning over at Crystal Rapids, he slowed down the motion so that. And the music was like a waltz. And it shows the people coming up and hanging on to the boat and all that. So it was a three-way production. And Martin was there for a month working with them, getting that film together. And as I say, it wasn't to advertise his company. It was to show people what the Grand Canyon was and the threats that could come up in the Grand Canyon.
Do you think it hurt bookings? I would think it would have helped to book trips.
Did he have what?
Well, he wasn't advertising, but do you think it hurt the bookings? I would think on the contrary that it the film would have helped people know about him and Grand Canyon, you know, and the Dorys and you know, kind of help the river trip business.
Yeah, well, it did, because people are aware of the fact that there were river trips in the Grand Canyon. And this way they knew what they would get into if they went, because it showed what was happening in the rapids and the quiet spots, and it gave them a vision of what was down in the bottom of the canyon.
Okay.
And it also told them about the history. So Martin was able, over the years, he was able to buy more user days so that he could offer more trips on the Grand Canyon. And the one trip that I was on, that Rich Turner was on as a passenger the first time he went. You know Rich?
I do know Rich.
Yeah, okay. All right, the first trip he was on, I don't remember what year it was, but he and his friend were on that trip, and I was on that trip. And there were some passengers who were going just for the 6 days, and they hiked out at right at Benham Ranch. One lady stayed on. So here we were with, I think, three boats empty except for one passenger and me.
Wow.
And then we got to when we had the side trips where usually the boatman would take the passengers on a hike, they figured that one person wasn't worth taking her for a hike. So when we got to Peach Creek, there's a fairly long, really lovely hike up the creek. And I did make somebody come along, one of the boatmen come along, to take this one lady up the creek. Anyway, I think she had, but that was one of the early trips where we were never sure that we were going to have enough passengers.
Right.
But I went only on a 1955 trip, and I think three others during the years that we had the river trips. I didn't go every year, and Martin, of course, couldn't go on every trip.
Right.
But I did go three times on the first one, which was 1955, and the last one, which was 1989. But in between, we did have, we would meet the pontoon parties, and many of the boatmen who worked for the pontoon parties wanted to come over and go to the dories. The colors on the dories were suggested by a friend of Pat Riley, who worked for Disney. And he, I don't know why he particularly liked these colors, but he suggested, I think they were automobile colors, Aztec red, burl green, and refrigerator white.
Okay.
So the dories were always painted in those colors.
When did you move out to Hurricane and put the warehouse out there?
Oh, well, the first trip that Martin ran, the first trips Martin ran were haphazard. And we started, he stayed in a motel in Kanawha. And got the boats together there and the boatmen and all. And so the first place was Kanawha, where he had the boat. Then in scouting the area, he found this unused auto parts store in Hurricane. And he arranged to, I think we bought the building. I'm not sure, but anyway, it became, well, somebody's at my door. I think they're going to take my temperature.
Okay.
Yes, what?
I'm going around with the this or that shop.
The what?
It's a shop.
Oh, a shop?
No, the shop.
No worries.
Yeah. Now I don't remember where I was.
Well, we were talking about
Canab, yeah.
Hurricane in Canab.
I think maybe we rented this space at first. It was a big air, a big space. And it had a shop, it had a store in the front part of the building. And there was a post office building. And anyway, the people in Hurricane were a little suspicious because it was the time of the hippies. And so many of our boatmen sported long hair. And one of our boatmen who was arriving by bus was stopped and arrested by the police when he got off because his hair was so long. And Martin had to come and get him at the police station and vouch for the fact that he was an okay person.
Wow.
So that would have been probably 71 that we moved into Hurricane Utah.
How long were you there in Hurricane?
Well, we were there forever.
Oh, okay.
We were there until Martin sold the company, and George Wendt didn't want to use the Hurricane place. He had a place in Flagstaff, so George did very well with our people. When he and John Vail purchased the permit, they kept all of our staff. And they kept all, and the Park Service required them to offer a trip with the dories. They could use the rubber rafts, which was mainly what they had, but they had to use the dories. They had to offer a trip in the dories, which they did. But we were there in Hurricane, as I say, until 1990. The trips ended in 1989, but I'm sure in 1990, we had purchased the warehouse. We were able to sell it, and then we moved everything got moved out into Flagstaff. We never had anybody killed as a result of the river trip. We had one man who came from Texas, and he'd always wanted to go on the Grand Canyon in the Colorado. And toward the end of the trip, he sat down while the rest of the people went for a hike on the side canyon. And he said, "I'll stay here and wait for you when you come back." But when they came back, he had passed away. And so that was our one death on the whole, all the years that we ran the river trip.
What a nice, peaceful way to go.
Well, I guess so. That was what he wanted.
Hmm.
We didn't want it. We didn't appreciate his choosing our place.
Oh, no, I'm sure.
But there was one gentleman from South Africa who came a couple of several times, at least three times. And he was a house guest of ours. But he had a heart problem. And he got to Elves Chasm. And was climbing Elves Chasm. And when he fell ill, and the boatman had to go down, get the oars and make kind of a way to, with ropes between two oars to carry him down to the river.
That sounds very hard. No worries.
Well, I don't know if you have other questions. We did have a few celebrities. One of the ladies, one of the announcers on 60 Minutes, I can't remember her name now, but she and Holbrook, Richard Holbrook, who later negotiated the Balkan War, the end of the Balkan War.
Yes.
She came along, and know which one it was, crew chief or what. But anyway, one of the cooks, one of the girls who was a cook, they reached to Peach. And you can hike up to Peach, and it leads to the North Rim, which is near a place called Jacob Lake.
Right.
It's a long hike. It's a long, long hike.
Yes.
But Diane Sawyer, that was who it was, Diane Sawyer. So she and the cook hiked up to a place where they had anticipated she would come out, and they had a car for her, and they drove her to Kanab Airport, where they had provided a plane for her so that she could get back to New York and do her interview in Russia.
Okay. I wanted to ask a little more about the warehouse in Hurricane. Were there any other problems with the town there, or just that one time with the one person off the bus?
No, that was just the one time. Because once we got settled, we used their local market to buy the food.
Right.
We used their local bank for our bank account. And we were really nice people. And they got acquainted with the people around there. It's a small town. It was a small town. I understand a major road goes through there now. But no, they became very friendly. And one of the girls who was our manager and stayed in Hurricane, she bought the apartment building where she was living, and she went into real estate after the company was sold. And she's a part of the community. She's not a Mormon, but she's been well accepted by the community.
Nice.
And another one of our boatmen bought the property, which was empty, next to the warehouse.
What was the name of the woman who was the managing of the shop there?
Jane Whalen, W-H-A-L-E-N.
Thank you.
And there was a man who wrote for us a while, Mike Taggart. And Mike Taggart purchased the corner part of the building and created a thing to be sold. It's called Chums.
Yes.
And you attach it to your glasses so that it'll hold your glasses against your chest so you don't lose them.
Nice.
And it's called Chums. And what he did was to use the women in Colorado City, which had been Short Creek, but was then called Colorado City. And those women created these tubes, cloth tubes that fit over the end of your glasses and hold the glasses against your body. And he's gone on and made quite a good business of it.
Nice. What was it like working with the Park Service prior, working with the Park Service to make more parks and champion safeguarding the parks, and then suddenly to find yourself as a concessionaire sort of with a different position with the Park Service? How did that work out?
It worked out very well. Martin was on very good terms with the superintendent. And at first, at the launching point at Lee's Ferry, there weren't very many many trips taking off. And for a long time, Edward Abbey was the representative of the Park Service, checking out the supplies and the different boats. And it was just a dirt ramp at the time. And there was no fee or anything. It was just for safety's sake that they were checking what your equipment was. But Martin had a good relationship with the superintendent and everybody up there on the South Rim. However, toward the end of our stay, in the late 80s, the Park Service decided that they needed to do more, charge more. They added fees for one thing and another, so that it became difficult. The fees amounted to thousands of dollars, and it became more and more difficult to keep going. because as it was when we finally sold, turned over the permit to George and John Vale, we come and said, you know, you're a minus $200,000 in return, but we're only minus to ourselves because we were only the ones, we were the only ones who owned Grand Canyon Dories.
Okay.
But it was a relief in a way, and as difficult as it was for the staff, because Martin didn't tell them that he was going to sell it. All of a sudden, this offer came, and he accepted it. And on the 1989 trip, I knew he was going to sell it. But and the crew was very suspicious. They wondered what was going on, and I couldn't tell them what was ahead until Martin did accept the offer. And then there were some hard feelings about it. They were very sad, and Martin for years felt very guilty about the way he had managed it and made apologies, and actually we stayed friends with all the crew, and so it worked out. But it was an uncomfortable situation because we were at a point where in November, at the end of the trip, there was a serious cash flow problem, and it kept getting worse and worse because Martin wasn't really charging enough for the trips and not paying the crew enough, and so it was a relief to turn it over to someone who was more businesslike and able to do better by the boatman and the cooks, you know, than we had done, although we stayed friends with them for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, nothing lasts forever, and by 1989, Martin would have been 70 or so?
Well, I don't know how old he was, but in 1987, this was a different thing that came up. In 1987, someone in the Sierra Club acreages, certain blocks of forest where they could cut. Society. So a group of local citizens got together to fight this clear cutting that was going on. And what Martin did was to fly over the area, because on the ground you couldn't see what was going on. So we flew over the area and took many, many photographs of the clear cutting that was going on. And Martin had those photographs enlarged into 11 by 14 and something like that, and mounted on a fiberboard. There were about 20 pictures that showed both winter and summer what was going on in the way of clear cutting in the national forest. And the appeal was to go to Congress and have the national forest turned into a national monument. But and Martin would go places with these 20 pictures and lecture and show people what was being cut by Rotary meetings or college meetings or committee meetings where they had hearings about what was going on, and he showed us. At the same time, there was an environmental group that started in Santa Monica about this same time. It was called Environment Now, and it was started by a man named Frank Wells. Is this important? Is this something you want me to keep on with?
Yeah, no, I'm interested. Keep going.
All right. Well, Environment Now, he had an office in Malibu in Southern California, and he was very wealthy. He had been the chief finance officer for Disney, and then had also worked as a finance officer for Warner Brothers. And he was very environmentally minded. He was concerned about what was going on in the environment. At the initial meeting in the late 80s that we went to in Malibu, there were other people with proposals to Mr. Wells, hoping he would take them on and finance their project. There was a lady who was pushing for saving the wolves, bringing the wolves back to Yellowstone. And she was campaigning for that. Martin spoke up for the danger that was what was going on in the giant sequoias. So ultimately, Mr. Wells did create the Sequoia Forest Keepers and started with a donation of $10,000. And the idea was that he would keep donating every year, you know, which I think they have done. But also, he expected the donee, the person who was getting this money, to send out grants to get money to keep the Sequoia Forest Keepers going.
Right.
Yes?
No, that's right. Typically, if you get money, you have to go out and make grants to get more money.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So the forest keeper who came on was a man named, he was on the committee, the local committee in the area there, that had been fighting to create a national monument, turn it into a national monument. And he took on the job of Sequoia Forest Keeper, and he is still there. It's just one person, and he has a secretary, and that's it. But every time the lumber company appeals to the Forest Service for a spot to log, the Sequoia Forest Keeper goes to the lawyers who do the work pro bono, and they can defeat the proposal. But the thing that happened, I must tell you, with all the campaigning and going to Washington, Martin began trips to Washington, D.C. to meet with Congress people to encourage them. I should back up, because what happened was, in the Clinton's administration, the Secretary of the Interior was Bruce Babbitt, and he was a friend of Martin's. So Martin was able to convince him, to urge Clinton to consider turning the National Forest into a national monument, which he could do at the end of his term as president. At the end, they can declare all kinds of things like national parks, national monuments, national this and national that. So at the end of his National Monument, which we thought was just great, except that when he did that, he kept the supervision of it, the administration of the monument, under the Forest Service, not the Park Service. Martin had hoped that as a national monument, usually the national monuments are under the supervision of the national park. And as a national part of the national park, it would eliminate the cutting of the forest. But he had left it under the Forest Service, so the appeals, the lumber companies could still come to the monument office and ask for permission to cut in certain areas. And so this, where they appeal to the monument now for permission to do the clear cutting, Ara, who is the Sequoia forest keeper, is alerted to their request, and through legal terms, they're able to stop it. But sometimes the legal business isn't done quickly enough, and the lumber company will start to cut, and then they have to stop.
Hmm.
Yes?
No, I just went humph, because that doesn't sound, you know, the trees get cut down. That's not right.
No, and it's clear cutting. And the only trees that they can't cut because the mill can't handle them are the huge sequoias. So we took lots of pictures. I would take some of the aerials from Arnon on the ground. He would take the pictures of these clear cut areas with maybe two or three giant sequoias left standing.
Wow.
And the problem with that is the bull. Well, I don't know what I should go on with that, the little thing like that. But essentially, that was Martin's life, or his project. We did meet the two photographers, Michael Powers and Mark Frazier, who came on about the time Martin got involved with the sequoias. And they photographed Martin, and they photographed the aerials, and they made a film about what Martin was doing in the sequoias, which I think they did sell it to TV, I'm not sure. But anyway, they were along, they were our partners in this, and they would bring the film to film shows. Telluride in Colorado has a Memorial Day vacation day. They have a mountain film festival, and the two photographers presented that film at the mountain film festival on Memorial Days, and they also showed it different film groups. One was in Flagstaff, one was in Santa Fe, so they made use of the film that they took of the problem of creating the national monument. But then, I guess I'm up to around the year 2000, because that took up most of Martin's time. We did have a chance. Martin at one point met a lobbyist, a man by the name of Carl Ross in Washington, D.C., who had an organization called Save America's Forest, and he was a one-man organization. But he had access to the Congress people. And so in his association with Martin, he came out to California, and we drove him over to the sequoias, and he saw what was happening there. But he made many appointments for Martin in Washington, D.C. for several years when Martin was trying to get the administration of the monument changed from the Forest Service to the Park Service. And to do that, he had to get a bill presented by Congress to make that change. So Carl Ross was able to secure appointments with Martin, with many of the congressmen, and Martin presented a portfolio and with the information, and usually you spoke to the congressmen's people who worked in the office. But often you didn't get to talk to the congressman himself. And I remember one of the times I went, it was to the office of Tom Newdall of New Mexico, but I don't remember the names of the other congressmen. But it was going door to door, person to person, many times trying to get support for a bill that would change the administration of the monument from the Forest Service to the Park Service, but it never happened. It has never happened. But it was quite an education to go to Washington, D.C., and go to the Hall of Congress. And when you see news reports where somebody's standing in the hall of the House of Representatives, that was where we were. And we visited so many of the representatives from whom Carl Ross had made appointments for Martin. And he went back several times. I went a couple of times. But they were all very agreeable, very hopeful. They would write the bill and do all these things, but nothing really happened.
Hmm. Okay.
But by this time, I'm trying to think, our last meeting there, the last time we went, was 2006. And before we left, because this is kind of interesting, before we left, we were leaving that afternoon, but Carl said there was a morning breakfast meeting for the senators from Illinois, and would we like to come to see what happens? Because residents of Illinois could come to Washington and speak directly with their representatives, their senators. And turned out it was Barack Obama, who was a senator at that time from Illinois, and Durbin was excellent. There were maybe two dozen people on chairs in this vast room, and they asked questions. They wanted help in one way or the other from one of the senators. And we, of course, were sitting in the back because we were from Illinois. But Carl Ross said, you know, at the end, you could have your picture taken. And I said, well, we're not from Illinois. That's all right. They wouldn't care who did that. Have our picture taken. So Martin finally accepted this, and all the residents of Illinois went ahead and had their picture taken. They shook hands with Barack Obama. They shook hands with Ben Durbin. So we were the last ones. And 2 years before had been Katrina, the Hurricane Katrina. So when Martin shook hands with Barack Obama, he said, well, as a senator, can you do something about helping New Orleans, maybe create another CCC, you know, because there's so many unemployed people. Barack Obama was very kind. He listened to him and said, and didn't say yes or no, but that was the extent of our visit with Barack Obama and Durbin, and we had a picture taken. So I think that what happened was that Carl Ross wanted his picture taken with them. That was why he urged us to go up and have our picture taken. So we were all in the picture. But that was 2006. I said, Martin's health was not good. He, in the years in between, he had had peritonitis, had been operated for that, and there were many flare-ups with the cellulitis and there were really some, and then in December of 2007, during the year, he had been quite ill with a urinary infection, and it was found that he had cancer on one of his kidneys. So in December of 2007, they operated, they removed that kidney, and then he planned to go on a river trip in 2008, but that obviously didn't work out. But anyway, in 2008, do you want me to go on with this?
Yeah, please.
Questions with this?
No, just as you remember it. Keep going.
All right. Well, 2008, on Earth Day, a TV group from Germany wanted to, had heard about the giant sequoias, and somehow they'd heard about Martin, and they contacted him on Earth Day, would he meet them and fly them over to see the Sequoias? So Martin agreed. We found them in Palo Alto, and they got in the Cessna, and they flew to Visalia, where they rented a car, and they drove up to the Sequoias, and they somehow Martin got back to the plane because the TV people were going to stay in Sequoia, and they were going to make their way back somehow. But Martin was going to return. He was through with the German TV people. And he had flown them all over the clear cuts and all that. So anyway, he flew back. He intended to stand to land in Palo Alto Airport, where we had the plane all the time in a hangar. But the wind was bad. It was a crosswind. And he couldn't, he didn't think it was safe to land. So he turned around and landed over the hills at a place called Los Banos, which has a big airfield, which is rarely used. There wasn't another plane on the field. But there's a motel across the street from it in Los Banos. So he landed there, and he called me, and he said the wind was too bad in Palo Alto, so he was going to stay in this motel. So the next day, it was clear as a bell. There wasn't a breath of wind, and I kept waiting for him to come. I even called the tower at Palo Alto Airport, and they said no Cessna had come in. And to make a long story short, I found out where the motel was and called them, and the lady called Martin's room, and nobody answered. And finally, he answered, but he didn't sound right. He wasn't making any sense. So I thought maybe the cellulitis had flared up again. So I got in the car and I drove to Los Banos. And I realized that he was in bad shape. So I called the urologist who had operated on him. And to make a long story short, he left the plane there and I drove him home. And he went to the hospital and he was there for a month, because he had a urinary infection that the doctors couldn't figure out what the bacteria was, and they didn't know what to use to treat him. So he left the plane back there. Unfortunately, our older son, who flies, was able to get over to that airport with a friend and fly the plane to his home over here in Antelope Valley. Because it didn't look like Martin was ever going to fly again, which, of course, he didn't. So that was the end of his flying days. And from 2008, it was, I don't remember what else happened, but it was a very serious urinary infection that kept on. And until 2013, when he had a flare-up of the cellulitis and the urinary infection, and he went into the hospital again, and then into a rehab place in Palo Alto, which was 2014, like in February, and he came home and required to have a caregiver with him, and the caregiver stayed with Martin for the rest of the year until Martin passed away in November the 30th of 2014. So that's kind of the end of the story.
Well, it is, but I want to ask you, Esther, in this journey with Martin, what were some of the things you were most proud about that you did?
Well, let me say this. I was able to take a few trips with this couple, the Cheesemans, who ran the Cheeseman Ecology Safari. So in January 1981, I went with them for 2 weeks to Tanzania, and was absolutely overwhelmed by Africa. And since I was working at school half-time and in contact with a lot of the students, and they often would ask me to, I would give them materials, instructional materials for their class. In my trips, not just that one to Tanzania, but later another trip I took with them to see the gorilla, and another trip when I went with them to see the Komodo dragon, each of the trips that I made, I tried to take pictures that I thought could teach the children about the places. Because there was a unit in, I think, the fourth grade about the rainforest. So in Suriname, which I had visited, the beautiful rainforest, and other places in the South Pacific have rainforest. So in that case, I would try to put together a film show, a slideshow that would appeal to the children of different ages when the teachers asked me to show my film, my slides. I would try to adjust them to the age group that I was showing. In my kindergarten, I had a film slideshow on Antarctica, and with the penguins and all, and then I would adjust the content according to the age group that I was showing a slideshow. So over the years, I really was happy and proud to be able to share what I was learning in other parts of the world, to show the children something they could understand about these different places. And I zeroed in on, of course, the wildlife and the plants and the animals and things that were natural to the areas. And in the 30 years that I worked part-time, half-time, 9 to 1, I made many, many good friends of the teachers and the kids and people who quit at school, both teachers and administrators. We formed a kind of tight-knit book group, which also lasted about 20 years, and from which I have very good friends with whom I communicate very, very frequently. So I guess I'm proud of the fact that I did try to bring some knowledge that the children could take advantage of, you know. And it wasn't just a happy time of traveling. It wasn't just a joy trip, but I did try to incorporate learning for the children.
That's really wonderful.
Well, thank you. Well, it was a great pleasure.
Gosh, I bet the kids really were able to learn a lot about the world that way.
Well, I hope so, at least the places I went to, because I also, in 1980, I saw a sign on the bulletin board of one of the schools, and some teachers who were considered overseas Chinese, that were called overseas, they were teachers over in across the bay in the Oakland School District. And these two overseas Chinese ladies, teachers, had organized a trip to China, a three-week trip in to China. And it was the first year that Americans were allowed to come to China. In 1979, the government, Mao had died in 76, but in 79 they relaxed the rules and allowed overseas Chinese to come to visit China. So these two ladies had visited China in 79 and realized that they could form a group of people. And so I signed up for that. And I did go to China for those 3 weeks. And it was a revelation. It was a wonderful trip. And I was able again here to bring back slides with which I could share with the children and show them what was in China, the beauties and the, oddly enough, in Beijing, there was no traffic and very little smog, although they cooked with charcoal. But the only traffic on the streets, any of the city streets at that time, were bicycles. And except for government vehicles and trucks and buses, there were no individual cars belonging to anybody. And there were no gas stations. And the streets were mostly, we left Beijing to go to the Great Wall, to visit the Great Wall. I was in a bus that was on a two-lane street. And what amazes me in the interim from 1980 to our present day, it's only been just over 30 years, and the amazing increase, the advances, and the modernization of China in those few years says a great deal.
It does.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the schoolrooms that we visited were very interesting, very Spartan. They had benches. All the children were dressed in white shirts and black trousers with a red bandana. And over the blackboard, there were no pictures on the wall, no instructional material, maps or anything on the walls. But above the blackboard was a photograph of whoever the premier was at that time in China, and Mao, a picture of Mao, and a picture of Marx and Lenin and Engels. And those were all the pictures they had above the blackboard.
Wow.
It was a ping pong table outside.
Huh.
It was a real education, a very pleasurable time. And we visited several cities. We didn't just stay in Beijing. We went to Xi'an, Luoyang, Guilin, and Canton. Well, it's not Canton now, it's Guangzhou. But we did manage to see quite a few of the cities. And the Beijing airport at that time, when we went to it, the parking lot was empty. There were no cars in the parking lot to speak of. And inside the airport, there were very few people. There wasn't that much travel. There wasn't that much going on. It was as if you were in a country of 1920, you know?
Yeah.
It was going back in time. So when I say it's remarkable what they achieved in those few years between 1980 and now, they got their act together.
It's been huge changes.
Yes, in many, many ways.
Well,
not necessarily good ways either.
Sure, just like there have been huge changes over your lifetime.
Yes.
Here in the U.S., yeah.
So I don't know if you have any other questions about the river trips or the sequoias or what I left out that you would like to include.
Well, I don't, except for this question. Is there anything else you would like to add to this interview series that we haven't talked about?
Well, I would say that about Martin's ability, he had an excellent speaking voice. His command of the English language was excellent. And when he went to a committee meeting or to any gathering, he was so well prepared that he spoke very eloquently and understandably about the issues at hand. And I was always surprised and amazed what ability he had to convince people with the proper, not in a bad way, but he had the facts. He had the information that they needed to make a decision, and speaking extemporarily, he had the same facility, so I would say that about his abilities and his writing. His writing was not easy. It was not easy for him, and I think that the reason that he complained about the editors moving a comma or period or semicolon was because he had labored very hard on what he had written, and he really objected to any changes. I think they made changes just to make a change, not because they thought it was needed to be done, but the editors probably thought they had a job. But Martin would really resent the changes that they made because he worried. He had worked very hard on what he wrote and the stories and the captions.
Well, this has been a wonderful series of interviews, and I just want to thank you again so very much for letting us do this.
Well, you're very welcome. If you think of anything else, any other aspect, why, I would be glad to cooperate.
Well, thank you so much. Can you hold the line for a minute? Hang on.